Welcome then to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. This is one of our special programs. All our meetings are open to the public and free, but from the time to time we do have a special program in which members and associates, visitors from other lodges join us in presenting a particular theme or aspect of the philosophy in a broader format. So there's time to go into the subject as wide or as deep as we'd like. And so we are pleased to say that we have associates and visitors from the United Lodge of Theosophists in Washington, D.C., who are here today to help participate and attending this meeting. So we call this a mini symposium, and it is on the format of several small presentations of about 7 to 10 minutes, leaving plenty of time for questions and answers. So it's combination lecture workshop, and for this conference mini symposium, we selected a title which, although timeless, relevance is also very important in our modern day world. Universal themes in world religions from the theosophical perspective. So we might mention to begin, for those of you who may not be familiar with theosophy, that one of the broader aims of the theosophical movement is the study of comparative philosophies and religions and sciences, Eastern and Western, ancient and modern, not only to understand them, but also to get an idea of the underlying fundamental truths that are at the heart of all religious systems. So we study them for their diversity, but for their underlying similarity. Just as human beings, we have an outer diversity, but in our core spiritual nature, we are one and inseparable. And that, of course, is the primary objective of the theosophical movement, the establishment of a nucleus of universal brotherhood, regardless of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, based on that fundamental spiritual unity. And of course, the very practical purpose of this study is to gain a truer realization of ourselves, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood, and to put that into practice in our everyday lives. So the philosophy, the movement is at one time spiritual, religious, philosophical, and scientific. So we say we're looking at these things from the theosophical perspective. We could not possibly cover all the different religious philosophies and systems out there. Even if we wanted to take one and we were a devotee of one, we could spend a full lifetime just scratching the surface. But what we do want to try to accomplish is explore several keys by which we can open to ourselves the fundamental system of any religion as well as theosophy. So we're going to look at 7 keys by which we can unlock that understanding. So whether we are a beginner or a more advanced devotee of that system, whether we've come into it by birth or adopted it in the course of our lives, we can get a better foundation of it, but also to see where it's similar to other systems. So for those of you who have a program, if you don't, there's one available at the usher's table. We are going to look at several keys, the first being that of the human predicament. The second will be life as a school, the reality behind illusion. And as we come to understand these keys, we'll see that there's a certain goal to religious life and a definite path by which different religions pursue that goal. And so the last 4 keys will be taken up in the last 2 talks, the path of action, path of meditation, the way of faith, and the way of devotion. So So these are keys by which we can approach this meeting. So we're going to begin with a brief presentation of the human predicament as it's understood by different religions, and then also understood by theosophy. So that we just keep in mind that there will be a short talk plus time for questions, and if you do not have a chance to bring your question up in a particular segment, you know, bring it up later on as it fits in. So here we are, the human predicament, and we're going to look at it from a religious point of view today. And we can say for sure that any one of us who has the sincere religious feeling, regardless of their particular path of devotion, recognizes that the world is not an ideal place in which to live. Something is wrong. There certainly is the presence among us of evil, injustice, and suffering in the world. So the religious life, to be religious, is not an easy thing. It's not an ideal place. And so in all religious systems, we see and try to see an explanation for this predicament. And one of the fundamental perspectives of religion is that our problems are primarily due to us feeling or being separate from God or the divine principle. And perhaps later we'll get different views of the God idea, but it's that general feeling of separation. And religion then, the word itself, means to tie back or to bind everything back to that fundamental divine source. So it is the separation which is seen to be the problem. And if we look at the broad spectrum of religion in the West and the East, we can see that in the West particularly, we have this foundation story in the Bible, which is a basic explanation of why we are separate from the divine. And it is probably one of the first biblical stories we all learn, regardless of our religious tradition. And that, of course, is the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and how the serpent, the deceiver, tempts Eve to eat of the apple from the tree of knowledge and of good and evil. And Eve, of course, has Adam eat it. And as a result of their sin, going definitely against the word of God, which was not to eat of any fruit of the tree of knowledge or the tree of life, they are expelled from the Garden of Eden and have to, Eve has to bring forth children in pain. Adam has to suffer and earn his living through the sweat of his brow, and we have the foundation of all suffering. So in Judaism and Christianity, this separation from the deity or the divine is seen through sin and direct disobedience of God's word. So if you want to understand those religious traditions, you must realize that that is the explanation for why we're in the problems we are. In the Islamic tradition, in a nutshell, it is that we are separate, we feel separate from God because we are continuously forgetting about God or the divine while we are immersed in this world. And so the whole point, everything in Islam is geared to a constant attempt to try to remember God in everything we do while in the midst of everyday life. And in one of our later talks, one of our presenters may go into that a little bit more. Now, in Hinduism and Buddhism and in the Eastern traditions in general, our suffering, our problems, is not so much due to forgetfulness or sin per se, but the fact that we are ignorant. We get confused. We mistake the illusions of this life for reality. And because we get wrapped up in the illusions of life, we are forgetful of who and what we are. We are forgetful of the divine. And we do many things that cause suffering. But the primary problem, the primary reason for our separation is that of ignorance of reality. And so we might say the goal of religious life in these different traditions is based on this fundamental explanation for why there is suffering. So we might say the goal of religious life is union with God. And one can look at it as a union with God afterlife, or the divine afterlife. So for the Brahman, for the Hindu, it's union, self-conscious union with Brahman, the divine principle. In Judaism and Christianity and Islam, it is union with God after life, after death rather, in heaven. And for the Buddhist, of course, it's union with that absolute principle, which is the negation of all physical material existence, called nirvana. And so in various systems, as we'll see, there's emphasis on one or more paths to reach that goal. And there are consequences established in the different religions. If we do not reach that union with God in this life, or we continue to forget God or sin against the divine, in Judaism, Christianity, Islam, for one who does not reach that union and continues to sin and forget, there of course is hell as a prospect. In Judaism, we see in some sects no mention of heaven, but certainly the idea of purgatory, where the soul goes to after life for penance for its sins. And then, of course, in Hinduism and Buddhism, in the Eastern religions in general, there is this idea that if you don't learn the lessons, if you don't get an understanding of reality, if you continue to make mistakes and forget the divine, then you're going to, under law, have to reincarnate in some condition until you do learn those lessons. So we might close this then with a broad theosophical perspective, and that is in theosophy, which means divine wisdom, we recognize, theosophy recognizes the human condition, that this is not an ideal place, that there is suffering and evil and in the world, but it's not so much as a sin or a forgetfulness of some outside God, but rather an ignorance or forgetfulness of who and what we really are. That in our highest spiritual nature, we are one with the divine principle, just as the rays of the sun are one with the sun itself, and the drops of the ocean are one with the ocean, the body of the ocean itself. We are in our spiritual nature identical, one and inseparable from that universal absolute divine principle. Theosophy also teaches that the human being is essentially a soul, a mind being, an immortal pilgrim, if you will, who in its essential nature is a spark, a ray of that universal principle, but in incarnation has a certain temporary instrument, a body, a personality in any one life by which it experiences. But the mind, once it incarnates, becomes dual. It feels part of that impulse, that intuition, that inspiration from within. It's the source of all our altruism and devotional feeling and leaning, but on the other hand, the mind is incarnated and involved in the senses, the organs, the passions, the memories, the sensations of the body, and identifies with that and believes itself to be that, and so forth, feels itself to be separate not only from life but from all other human beings and from that divine source in general. And based on that feeling of separateness, there grows the idea of selfishness, what's in it for me, what do I need to do to survive and satisfy my desires, and a forgetfulness of our fundamental unity. So the purpose of religion then, or true religion in whatever form, is to remind human beings who and what we are. And it is a teaching of theosophy that in all the different religious systems, whether we look at Eastern and Western, behind all the outer rituals and all the doctrines and all the things that seem to separate them, like the different colors of the rainbow, there is a fundamental unity of teaching, a fundamental wisdom of the ages, which can be perceived there. And so we study that fundamental unity in all of life. So we are presenting then this subject of the human predicament as an introduction to our meeting. So as we go along, then we will have our short talks, leaving time for questions. So we'd like to move then to our first presentation this morning, which is on Life is a School. And if everything we said is true about the human predicament, then all religions must have some teaching that we are here to learn. We are here to transcend. We are here to pass the test of the problems of life, and there has to be something in that religion that teaches us about ourselves and about our destiny.
So, our next title for this morning's mini-symposium is Life is a School. And if we think about the Western religions that were just mentioned, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, the people of the book, literally, we are thinking about folks who hold with a particular linear perspective of time or history and progress. These are folks who, in their religious studies, are looking at life as a probational experience, if you will, but it's linear. They are born, they live, they die, the eternal goes on, and there's a linear sempiternity opportunity, if you will, to practice the faith, to submit to the teachings of the faith, and therefore to either reunite with the divine or to fail. In the East, whether we're thinking about the major religions of Hinduism or Buddhism or another, in general, it's not a linear straight line kind of experience with life as a school or the gaining or goal for wisdom. Rather, in the East, the teaching is circular or cyclical or a spiral, if you will, as a symbol. So in the East, with the teachings of re-embodiment or reincarnation, some religious faiths teaching transmigration, there is an experience in life in the incarnation, and then soul recedes and may come again if the lessons of life are not learned. That is, if there is not a devotional practice that's successful that leads the soul to a reunification with the divine. And so when we think about this probationary period, for a member of one of these religions, there's a very unique kind of a perspective. And again, in Judaism and Christianity, we have a range of possibilities because we know that across the decades or across the centuries, these major faiths have branched, they've split. But in Judaism, for instance, there is the notion that the individual born innocent may fail. There may be a disobedience of God's laws, if you will, but the opportunity to try again is there. That kind of lesson is embedded, if you will, in the story of Adam and Eve in Genesis. So born innocent, learning by trial and error, attempting to try again, seeking to align the wisdom gained in life as a predicament, and then serving as best as possible, the importance of learning, the importance of debating the issues of what is it to lead an ethical life? How do I avoid sin? What is sin? That kind of study done with priests or ministers or rabbis is what is so very, very crucial. And we can see the tradition in the West of faith being very tested. If we think of the story of Job, if we think of the story of Abraham and his son, we know that human beings can be tested to see if the faith or the wisdom, the learning gained, is pure and has been successful. In Christianity, there's an overlay to everything just said about Judaism, if you will, because in Christianity, although the effort is there, the soul is considered in most Christian sects to have been born in original sin, to have been born under the influence of that fall in the Garden of Eden. And so different Christian subsets demand a variety of remediations for that original sin notion. Children are taught that they need desperately to have a translator, if you will, and that ranges from very orthodox Roman Catholicism, where the priest will translate scripture, translate the New Testament, the Old Testament, the lessons to be learned, all the way over to a more emphatic born-again range where the individual is taught to read so that he or she can read the Bible for themselves and consider it, ponder it, and then follow it literally. Be that as it may, across the board in Christianity, with a few far liberal exceptions, if there is not this reconciliation of a faith in the Christ as the Messiah and the belief in the sacrifice of that unique Messiah, then, in essence, life as a school is going to be useless. Because unless that faith and declaration is maintained, however the trials come in life, however the mistakes are made, if there's not that hearkening back to that reconciliation of a unique outside Savior, then the learning is not permanent. In Islam, as was said earlier in the introduction, the emphasis by the Prophet was on helping people reform their path of life so they're not distracted by the beauty and the grandeur and the sensual nature of life on the planet. The human being is not considered to be born in sin. There's a purity there, but there is incredible temptation according to the sensory realm. And so we see in the Sharia, the individual national teachings on how to fulfill the terms of the Quran. We see instructions about veiling women and the use of money and a whole variety of practices. Unique to Islam, meaning submission, is the five pillars or five daily practices. And we can see themes of that in the Christian church, but there's a very succinct list of reminders across the course of the day. These are meant to be devotional, ritual behaviors so that the individual soul can recall what it is to know the divine. There are all sorts of devotions and rituals done with food and cleansing and five times a day, there's a daily prayer. The practice of charity is very, very, very important, especially on a daily basis. Fasting during Ramadan is an annual cycle. It is frequently a cycle offered to non-Muslims to break Ramadan with the Muslim in an effort to offer learning to the other. And then once in a lifetime, if not more, the pilgrimage to Mecca. Now, in Hinduism and Buddhism in the East, we may also see a sacrificial pattern across 24 hours of a day. There may be rituals of offering sacrifice to a deific essence. There may be a home that's dedicated or a family line dedicated to a particular deity. But the rituals and the sacrifices are invitations to recall the nature of life and to learn better to apply ethics in regular life so that ultimately the wisdom gained is attempting to be karma less, to act in the right manner, so that there is no self-centered illusions, delusions, or greed, if you will, but rather how to serve the divine as it is presented behind the illusions of life. Now, despite the differences, and we could talk about the difference between Calvinistic Christianity and Catholicism or different avenues of Judaism and Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, there are certain universal themes that we could talk about in the Q&A portion that can be found by comparing scriptures. All of them point to the fact that all of these apparently illusionary different religions behind the scene of the religion, they all point to the fact that life is a school and that humans can learn or perfect themselves. They all teach man is created in God's image, that the potential for the divine is also in man. They all teach that it's better to examine the self rather than the other. Judge not, so ye not be judged. They all have a scriptural teaching that man does not live by bread alone, and that it is wisdom, it is the spiritual that is the true nurturing force in life. They all teach that wisdom is more than riches or materialism, that they all teach to honor the elderly with the presumption that after so many years of life, after decades of living and trial and error, that the elderly have wisdom to share with the very young. And they all teach that the search for wisdom should begin at a very young age.
So we invite you with your own questions and comments. If it's in a particular religion background, we'll try to do our best to answer it. Or if it's relating to the theosophical approach to this idea of life as a school. Yes, in the back.
Could we have a discussion here so that we may be able to identify? It seems that there's been a loss of identity.
The question, could there be some discussion on the religious idea of who we are, our fundamental our identity?
The great irony is that many in the Western religions believe that they have a soul, but that this soul is created by an external personal God, a deity, and this soul is created for one life and one life only. But because, especially in the different schools of Christianity, because man is a lowly sinner, then in the human condition, sin is the normal. Sin is acceptable. But when you look into the different scriptural promises, man is created in the image of God. If we just take that one theme, in Judaism, God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. There we have the notion of the external creator, but and the human is a reflection of that divine. In Hinduism, the individual soul is nothing else in essence than universal soul, And there we see in the Eastern school of thought the notion that I am universal soul, I'm a reflection of the deific essence, and therefore potentially life is a tremendous school. Very different implication. And so it goes through Islam, Sikhism, God is concealed in every heart. His light is in every heart. In Christianity, know ye not that ye are the temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwelleth in you? So if we step behind the rituals and behind some of the teachings, I need a priest, I need a rabbi, I need a minister, etc., in the scripture is something very different.
How do we make contact then with that perceiver, that individuality, that the witness to all of this? And is that part of the school? Is that what we should be looking to do or trying to find a path?
Well, each of the religions has a scriptural reference to how to live. And the invitation, or maybe the directive, however you want to see that, is to look within. In other words, to consider life in terms of what have I done this day to fulfill a divine promise, or where have I made a mistake and not fulfilled it. And always and everywhere, all these major religions teach that it's better to examine the self, to think about, to go through the process of using mind and heart, or the eye and heart doctrine, as would be said in Hinduism and Buddhism, to reflect on life. In the teachings of Confucius, it says, if you love others and affection is not returned, look into your own love. If you rule others and they are unruly, look into your own wisdom. If you treat others politely and they do not return your politeness, look into your own respect. If your desires are not fulfilled, turn inward and examine yourself. And that teaching can be found, Taoism, he who knows others is discerning, he who knows himself is wise. In Sikhism, they who quarrel with others instead of quarreling with their own hearts waste their lives. So that would look theosophically as an invitation to meditate, wouldn't it? When we think of Judge's article of the culture of concentration, to meditate in the morning, to meditate in the evening, set a tone for the day, at the end reflect on how we did, and in between times attempt to develop this point of view of examining what we're doing and why we're doing it and how we're doing it.
We'll take it.
In the Gita, it says that we are compelled to act.
Yes.
Okay. How much time should we be worrying about ourselves and what we do, what we think about, or because we have to act and we find ourselves, our actions are consumed in, making money or doing this or doing that. And we keep on hearing service to humanity.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a path, or is there a formula for how we should spend our attention?
Well, when we think about meditation, we hear people say, I'm sitting for the practice, or I'm practicing yoga, I'm practicing balance. And when we think about how we learn to ride a two-wheel bicycle as a child, the training wheels were there, the conditions were that we were real wobbly, and then maybe an elder sibling or a parent ran alongside of us and held us up while we learned to pedal and steer and balance all at once. But it took repetition, it took practice. So if we internally have this ideal that we should be able in any moment to be on top of things, to think from or to reason from or to feel from that divine within, we're not going to be perfect at that initially. So if we find ourselves, as our friends who are Muslim would say, you're forgetting who and what you are. If we find ourselves, as our Jewish friends might say, whoops, you really messed up there and made a mistake. That's what it is to be soul resident in the human state. And as we become more and more aware of what it is to be soul living in the human state, and we practice turning our minds back to the divine, as the Muslims do with their five pillars, as many Christians do with the ringing of the Angelus bells in neighborhoods where folks are supposed to stop what they're doing, and periodically, every 4 hours, stop, think, and pray, recenter. It takes practice, and it may be something we have to design for ourselves to do.
Mm-hmm.
There was
a question.
But according to the religions that you have just explained for us, especially in the Christian, we're inherently imperfect because you said that we're sinful. Now, that premises everything that a human being is. If I'm inherently imperfect, where's the possibility of reaching perfection, which you said that it is behind all of the religious conceptions if you take the past away and look to the inner meaning of things?
Maybe one of the perplexing strands of Christianity that we could study to try to understand is the sects that follow the teachings of Calvin. Calvin, who taught predestination of soul, that prior to birth, God the Creator created a particular soul and created the conditions of that life so that soul was predestined to walk a particular path. Somebody was predestined to be crippled. Someone else was predestined to be blind. Someone else was predestined to be discriminated against in some way. The deific invitation would be, regardless of condition or predestination, regardless of this innate sinfulness, faith in Christ, the practice of good works, acceptance of whatever comes, turning the other cheek, means that at the end of that life, that one may be saved despite those conditions.
But you're leaving everything to chance. Predestination means I am responsible for it, for I have done. There's no outside element or deity or power that causes that things to come to me. It is my personal action that brings...
Theosophically, that would be the teaching.
But
theosophically.
Scientifically, if you throw a ball, it will bounce off the wall and will come back to you. It's the same in human life. So responsibility for my actions is not there. How can we say that some outside force is giving those things to me? Some person is rich, another one is very poor. Some has tremendous intelligence, another one does not.
Mm-hmm.
One is spiritually totally attuned to the divine, and the other one totally attuned to the materialistic life.
Mm-hmm.
So the mind that the first speaker talked about has to be acknowledged in working in two different ways when we are incarnated. Otherwise, everything is just totally, does not make any sense.
Your argument, certainly, is centered in reasoned faith, in the use of logic, in the use of science, in the use of philosophy. And having said that, there are others around the globe who sincerely, in a very, very pure-hearted manner, are devoted to a blind faith, who accept particular teachings unaware, literally unaware of the underlying truth many, many centuries before. So while we may argue or defend our validity of our arguments, it's equally important to respect where the other people are coming from, so that we see how is it that we're similar.
Oh, respect is definitely extended.
Yeah.
Well, I think Mr. Judge states it. explains everything, the karma and reincarnation. So the truths that have been twisted and turned to suit a certain power base or whatever, they're not true. It's empty. So, I mean, the foundation goes back to the truth, which is reincarnation and karma.
Yes.
The last quarter of Christianity.
Yes, yes. And those of us that may be standing outside, it's easier to see. But that is not an invitation to tear down someone else's faith and belief system. It's an invitation to understand the limits of what they've been taught, why they think the way they do, and then to seek commonality in order to promote mutual understanding.
The assumption is, as you say, that life is a school. So who designs the curriculum?
That gets back to the two ideas. Is it an outside God, or
exactly.
Is it our own individual actions? But
yeah, in most of the organized religions, the designer is the outside God, a personal deity. And again, depending on the religion, it might be a very vengeful notion of what God is. Theosophically, if we're looking over all this, we have to wonder, with all these religions, there's embedded in the religion, in the scripture, the reality that as a human being ages, as they have lived their lives, they have a tremendous font of wisdom available for the young. That wisdom in all these religions is based on experience in the school of life, not on divine revelation or interpretation. So in every single one, there is the notion to honor an old man is to show respect for God. There is the notion that it's not the birth of the child that is so very valuable, but rather after the experience of life is when reverence and great nourishing can be gotten from that individual. There's a hand way in the back.
In the earlier discussion, we think it's wise to ask ourselves, before I discovered these amazing theosophical ideas, how was I thinking, acting, and reasoning 10 years ago, 20 years ago? We can look back and see that we place our faith and honored a religious teaching, and it helped to bring us where we are now.
Mm-hmm. Well, karmically, as soul, we came into a life circumstance with certain tendencies and certain environmental and family influences. And as we sit here today, we may actually be part of a huge family line, and we may be one of the few who's broken ranks and gone for the search for truth and stepped outside the family teachings.
Okay. Did you want to finish your comment?
No.
Okay, because I want this gentleman.
I have a question regarding the topic of being either judgmental or non-judgmental.
Yeah.
I'm bringing this up because I've studied a lot of the topic of mindfulness, which within Buddhism promotes the idea of being in the present moment in a non-judgmental way. However, it is really common, maybe it's not necessarily part of the teachings, and in this you can clarify me this or not, but my impression is that many religions in the world can be quite repressive and excessive and promote being judgmental in the point of view that, let's say, our school is the school,
yes,
and every other school is not so much. I recall one bad metaphor. I remember one leader said, our school is the equivalent to a Ferrari, and everything else of any religion you find out there is nothing but a banged up Volkswagen. I remember that metaphor once, and I personally feel more attuned with the non-judgmental point of view from Buddhism,
mm-hmm,
and mindfulness and meditation. And wanted to ask, is this your point of view on whether inherent in among schools, or?
When I looked into the subject matter and came across, you know, take the beam out of your own eye before you try to take the mote out of the other, what I recalled was, if there is a faith that has stepped away from the universal teaching that we are all from one source, that at heart, at essence, at spirit or soul, we are all exactly one, and that we are here probationary, all learning together, all attempting to understand and to put into practice divine ethics, if there's a religion that's teaching it's our faith or the highway, we're the only ones that are saved by the sacrament of baptism or the sacrament of extreme unction, or we're the only ones that are the chosen people, or, you know, we're, congratulations, we're going to have to kill you and wipe you out to save your life, as was done in the Crusades, and some fanatics now hold. They've left the path of what theosophically would be the eternal truth. And there's a bigotry, an incredible bigotry being taught. If a young child is taken and taught that, then they're going to have a struggle for a search for truth. And it might be quite a struggle.
So we think the whole point of this presentation is that no one religious system is the school, any more than one color of the rainbow, as beautiful it is, represents the whole rainbow. You have to understand the synthesis. And that life itself, which we all experience, is a school. And the best one any religion can hope to be is a small classroom in that larger school of life. So we appreciate that you may have more questions, but we do want to move into the next subject. Seven keys. We're going to get to the next key. Yes. So we've looked at the human condition as a key. If you want to understand a religion or your own religious attitude, what do you understand to be the human predicament in the face of this is not a great place, a great world to live in, ideally? How do you understand that predicament? How do you resolve it? What is the key to your religion in explaining it? And the second key to be is, what does your religion or your personal ethic teach you about life as a school? The importance of not just living for enjoyment, but learning the lessons that life has to give us. So let's go to the next subject, which is really the third key. And after this presentation, we're going to take a 10-minute break so you can refresh yourselves and digest some of these ideas. But if we're going to learn, the next key would be to understanding a religion is, it, how does it teach us, living in this world full of illusion and chaos and things we got, how does it teach us to discern what is really true, what is really important, how to garnish that reality, that truth, that wisdom in this school of life from the illusion around us? So we'll have this presentation given, and then you'll have time for questions.
And so the topic to consider for this presentation is the reality behind the illusion. Or said differently, maybe, how elusive is reality? Or is our reality really an illusion? Well, greater is he who has conquered himself than he who has conquered 10,000 men. And so if there's a conqueror of oneself, what is it that does the conquering, and why should he do the conquering? You know, there's a lot of conquering that goes on among these religions. But what we're taught in theosophy is that all of the great religious teachers come here with a portion of theosophy to offer mankind at different times, at different places, according to different conditions for what he's ready for. And no one of them is teaching something that's more true than the other one. All of them have material or principles from the same source. The difference between any of them is, what has the student done with the teaching? Has he received the teaching and passed it on to others as he's received them? Or is there something, some kind of a spin going on? So the spin is the illusion. The true teaching is the reality in that sense. And perhaps a helpful example of that is, you know, in any of the world's religions, we can think of symbols. We could think of Christ dying on the cross as a symbol. We can think of the Star of David as a symbol, which actually is a symbol that's found in different religions and even in Freemasonry and means many different things to many different people. So the challenge here, the question here is, has the student learned the principle and passed the truth on to others as he received it? Well, when a spin is put on to the truth, or when there's illusion going on there, that symbol, which is so obvious to us because we can see it, feel it, touch it, smell it, taste it, if we're not taught and if we don't make the effort to recognize the principle behind the illusion, then we take that symbol to see the principle behind the symbol. We take that symbol and we make that symbol the reality. And by making the symbol the reality, we lose the reality within the symbol. And so many people who talk and study and read about the history of all these different religions, who will argue endlessly about whether this person really was or that really wasn't, or is this religion the same as it always has been, the student of theosophy looks to the history of religion and says, this is ridiculous, it's a waste of time, you're never going to know, and it's not worth it. The question is not, is this religion the true religion? The question to the student of theosophy is, what truths are there that I can discern in this religion that I'm going to be able to use in service to others? And a person who has conquered himself can look at any of these religions and know and recognize, wow, if I've done the work, a person who's done the work, who is in the process even of conquering himself, he's going to see the common teachings in all the religions. As opposed to, think of someone who works for the FBI, who is back in the days before computers, trying to discern counterfeiting. Okay? If they're trying to discern a counterfeit $20 bill, the FBI didn't teach their specialists, okay, this is all the million different ways you can counterfeit a $20 bill. So if you ever see one like this or this or this or this, no, that's not how they did it. They said, this is what a $20 bill looks like. This is the real McCoy. Now compare it to any of these and tell us which are the counterfeits. Theosophy offers us the real McCoy. We can look into the ideas in theosophy wherever we come from, whether we come from a religious family, whether it's people of the book or from the wisdom traditions such as Buddhism and Hinduism are considered the wisdom religions as opposed to theosophy, the wisdom religion. And then there are the revealed religions, the people of the book. Well, all the principles are there. And so, if we've lost touch with our principles, we're living in the illusion. Now, fortunately, there are ways to get past this illusion. And this is where the ancient teachings come in. And the ancient teachings have been kept alive in the older religions. In the West, it's gone through the cycle, it's lost a lot. The ethics of any of the revealed religions is as true to the original as it ever was. But because of the way man thinks and because of the cycles, we've lost touch with the lost chord of Christianity. That's not to say that the teachings aren't there to live an ethical life. But fortunately, there are teachings in the East that had been brought to the West, and now we are told actually it's the responsibility of the West to apply them, and guess what? Teach it to the East. The teachings were there, but they weren't really used and applied as one sometimes might hope. So some of these teachings, for instance, in Hinduism, the idea is the goal to recognize what's reality, what's the reality behind the illusion. The goal is to get out of the cycle of existence, and the cycle of existence to the Hindu simply is this reincarnation, continuous reincarnation. Well, we reincarnate, we are taught, because of our own ignorance. And it's the man's own inherent power to learn and to grow and to self-illuminate will raise him beyond the necessary requirements of reincarnation. We reincarnate because of our ignorance. A Mahatma does not reincarnate. Perhaps he'll take on a body, but that's completely different from the process of reincarnation than most of mankind. Spiritual illumination is the means by which man frees himself of this cycle of illusion. And to the student of theosophy, spiritual illumination simply is a truer realization of the self. And a truer realization of the self simply comes about by what? Learning the principles, getting back to the true religious ideas. A truer realization of the self by exemplifying those principles and perhaps even teaching them to others in the right time, at the right place, in the right circumstances, because the more we serve and teach others, really, the more we learn ourselves. Isn't that true? So a truer realization of the self by applying spiritual principles in Hinduism or in the school of theosophy, it's the same thing. It's spiritual illumination. And there's only one thing, ultimately, in Hinduism that is real. And that's the thing that does the conquering, the Atman, the God within, the highest reality within the human being. You know, greater is he who has conquered himself than he who conquers 10,000 men. It's not the inner spirit that's trying to get out there and conquer other people. Right. And then we have the process that we might take, or the ideas that we might consider to get a better idea of reality or to approach reality, is really through Buddha's teachings, the Four Noble Truths, which is, you know, all life is suffering. It's all grounded in our personal desires. If we accept that everything around us continues to change and let it go and know that the conqueror is permanent and identify ourselves with the conqueror and not be so attached to the other stuff. The more that we become attached to the outside things, the more, so to speak, it hurts when we lose it, right? So we fail to recognize this, that everything in this existence is a temporary illusion. HBB tells us the student will ceaselessly question himself, ceaselessly question your own motives. Reality is never what it seems to be, so to speak. What we perceive as reality is never what it truly is. The second of the Four Noble Truths is, you know, clinging to the impermanent is the cause of the suffering. So attachment, clinging to the impermanent, letting go of that, or living in the moment in certain ways is the answer to the suffering, non-attachment. And then finally, of course, Buddha's Eightfold Path, right living and right speech, right acting, right mindfulness. But karma explains the justice and the injustice of all of this. In any of the religions, reincarnation answers so many of the unanswered questions. And karma can be much more clearly understood when thought in concert with reincarnation. But the idea of karma is in all the religions: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And so we'll leave it there, and we'll open the floor for contributions and discussion.
being a school, what happens when we graduate? What are we graduating into, or what is the goal of life?
So the question is, you know, what happens when we graduate from this school? Or in other words, perhaps, what happens when we finally learn to discern the real from the temporary, perhaps? You know, well, we start where we're at, and we could approach this from an idea of, you know, the real is, it has to be by definition impersonal. It has to be by definition selfless. It has to be by definition beyond that which evolves. So as we find, wherever we find ourselves, am I perfectly selfless? No. Am I probably selfish in certain ways? Probably so. But not in every way. So there's certain ways that I've moved. We, anybody, you, all of us, we move from selfishness to unselfishness, to living in service to our family or our friends or our community. And there's and as the evolution where the application of universal principles continues and we learn and we observe and live mindfully and continue to evolve, the idea is we become less and less selfish, more and more unselfish, and the process brings us to a point where we are selfless. So the graduation ideally would be when we are perfectly selfless. But in the meantime, if we accept false ideas, it's hard to even get going. So consider this idea of inherent being inherently imperfect. Inherent perfectibility means the process of evolution can always continue, regardless of conditions. Yes.
Well, one of the biggest illusions seems to be that the mundane everyday person in most of these religions is taught one thing about the nature of God or the saints or the minor deities or the angels. There's a face-on deity, but there's, for the priests and for the esoteric enlightened ones, isn't there another common teaching that there is the unknowable deity, the unapproachable, the non-categorized? So in Islam, you would never see Allah illustrated in any artwork. In Judaism, you would never see the word God spelled out completely because it's hearkening back to an unknowable source. Yes? No? Maybe?
That's, thus have we heard. So many good folks in the religions, at the very minimum, recognize that, you know, there is this reverence for that which is beyond the unknowable. So often, when it comes to different people being taught different things in different religions, the challenge there is it's like they're wearing different color glasses. They're wearing different color goggles, and they're seeing through one through the blue and one through the red, and everything in this world I see through the red. The student of theosophy moves toward, hey, let's get a purely clear pair of goggles so we can see what the reality for what everything is and discern that. Because to the extent that we either choose not to make that effort, or to the extent that we choose to preach just the red, that in and of itself is violence. And we're not talking about physical violence, but it's violence because when we see another through our own lens and make a judgment through our own red lens and make a judgment, well, he is red in this sense or he's not, really he's white, so to speak, the white light. And if we say he's anything other than that or define him anything other than that, really we're violating his identity. And to violate someone else's identity in and of itself is an act of violence, isn't it?
To follow up then on a previous question, if as the Buddha taught the nature of illusion is that which is changing, continuously, temporary, impermanent, and the reality must be, from the Buddha point of view, and also universal wisdom, that which is permanent, that which is enduring, that which is, does not change. Is there a principle that we can recognize in ourselves as human being, which is real, is divine in that sense, doesn't change, is permanent, is enduring, always is, ever was, will be? Is there that divine principle we can recognize?
So what is that divine principle within us that is, you know, what is that conqueror? And that is, as we said, that's referred to by the Hindus as Atman, or in Theosophy we usually see the word Atma. It's the highest, purest ray of the divine, and it's actually who and what we are. Everything, every thought, every sensation outside of that we identify with is a distraction. It's an illusion, and we lose sight of who we are, and if we fall in love with that and investigate that, we tend to forget who we were, and welcome to planet Earth. Right? Yes?
Well, I'm beginning to get the idea why they call these roads, Theosophy, the Great Sifter. Now, by Great Sifter, are you saying that eventually we'll overcome our confusion as to the truth, and that this predicament will cease eventually when we know the truth?
So the question here, okay, the Great Sifter, we haven't heard that reference before, but will, could, the last part of that is, how are we going to know it when we know the truth?
Yeah, well, we've heard that in these rooms, that these teachings are a Great Sifter.
Sure. Perhaps, as we study life and Theosophy generally, or all the particular religions, however one's path brings one in along these ideas, at this stage of the game, we've got a certain philosophy that kind of fits together and it works, you know? And so there are times when we've figured it all out, and then we learn something else, and while we're used to hanging it, okay, well, that obviously belongs on that hook, suddenly there's no hook for this one. Wait a minute. We've learned a truth that we didn't know. So that's truth to us right there. If the result is, I have to do this and start rearranging and make it bigger so I can make, okay, now the puzzle is complete, we're done, you know? And we live it and learn it and teach it, and suddenly what happens? We're to a place where something else comes along. So who's to say when, where, or how we actually get the real, final truth? As long as we live in a conditioned life, we can talk about the idea. It's an ever-continuing uphill march toward the truth. You know, the unilluminated, we seek the truth. The adept is found by the truth. That's what we've heard. Yes.
Was there another?
Yes.
Yes.
That reality behind illusion is that one conquers oneself. It is better than conquering 10,000 people.
The question here is, was it said that the reality behind the truth is the conqueror of oneself? We were trying to, sometimes it's helpful in Theosophy, we find it when we use correspondence or analogy. And so in that idea of it's, you know, the conqueror of self is the truth. So in that sense, our inner self, our spiritual nature, the ray of the divine that we truly are, that in and of itself has been said to be the truth.
Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, yes, a follow-up.
Go ahead.
You said every, like, religion is using glasses, colored glasses, sort of. Every religion, and they see what they want to see. We
That's the idea.
Repeat that.
So there was a statement. So then, in certain ways, each religion has its own colored glasses, its own assigned particular hue or shade, and makes the effort to teach, but at the same time, probably all of us have found that we can talk to people of different religions, and when you talk to theosophy to certain people in different religions, really they think that, well, that's my religion, what you're saying, you know, because really the theosophical ideas can be found in all the religions. The question is, do we present them to our neighbors in ways that they can understand
yes.
it?
Yeah, because, you know, they say soul does not have any color. Soul does not have any shape. You cannot touch it.
We would say that. We would say certainly. The question is a soul something without color or shape? Well, certainly the soul is metaphysical. Certainly the soul is, it's not like the soul isn't here in existence. The soul is comprised of substance. There's a fine substance. But we're told that the substance of the soul is all of the highest experiences, the spiritual aspirations and experiences that we've gone through in all of our lives, that we've made the effort to assimilate into our character and learn from. All of those experiences synthesized and assimilated into our soul is what our soul is.
Thank you. Well, we're going to have more opportunities after our 10-minute break to look into the other four keys and fill out our understanding on this subject. So we invite you to take a few moments of break.